Hi, I'm Andrew Proctor, and you're listening to a special episode of the Archive Project, in which we're featuring events from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, a panel titled Resistance and Rebellion, Dystopian Fiction, recorded in November 2017 at our book festival. It features some of our most essential writers at work today, Benjamin Percy, Lydia Yuknovich, and Omar El Akkad. The panel is moderated by Portland Monthly senior editor Fiona McCann. Each of these books is a daring act of imagination, one rooted in our current reality, but that speculates on a future that could be. It is tempting to talk about these books as allegories, parables, warnings, but all these descriptions are much too limiting. Great fiction often includes these characteristics, but is also so much more. These writers deliver a fully realized version of our world, and because of their talent as storytellers, allow us to accept a version of the future defined by strange new rules, bounded by circumstances we do not yet experience. And in so doing, they allow us to see our present with fresh new eyes. What matters about each of these writers is that they are all pushing boundaries, and yet their work remains wildly entertaining, even as it often frightens us. Here's our moderator, Fiona McCann.
Thank you all so much for coming out to what I believe is one of the last events. Just to introduce myself, my name is Fiona McCann, and I am a senior editor at Portland Monthly Magazine. I've been writing about arts and culture for about 20 years now in various different places, including my home country of Ireland, Argentina, and now here in Portland. And I'm just going to introduce you to the authors here beside me. Let's see, we have Lydia Yuknovich here, is the author of the national best-selling novel, The Small Backs of Children, which was a winner of the 2016 Oregon Book Awards Ken Kesey Award for Fiction, as well as the Reader's Choice Award. The novel Dora, A Head Case, and three books of short stories. Her memoir, The Chronology of Water, was a finalist for a Penn Center USA Award for Creative Nonfiction and a winner of a PNBA Award and the Oregon Book Award Reader's Choice. And her most recent novel is The Book of Joan, and she also has another book forthcoming based on her recent TED Talk called The Misfits Manifesto. And she lives here in Oregon with her husband. So welcome, Lydia. Thanks for joining us. Here beside Lydia, we have Omar El Akkad, who was born in Cairo, Egypt, and grew up in Doha, Qatar, until he moved to Canada with his family. He is an award-winning journalist and author who has traveled around the world to cover many of the most important news stories of the last decade. His reporting includes dispatches from the NATO-led war in Afghanistan, the military trials at Guantanamo Bay, the Arab Spring Revolution in Egypt, and the Black Lives Matter movement in Ferguson, Missouri. He is a recipient of Canada's National Newspaper Award for Investigative Reporting and the Gough Penny Memorial Prize for Young Canadian Journalists, as well as three National Magazine Award honorable mentions. His most recent book is American War, and he lives right here in Portland, Oregon now. Welcome, Omar. And finally, we have Benjamin Percy, who is Oregon-born, has won a Whiting Writers Award, a Plimpton Prize, and a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. He is the author of the novels The Deadlands, Red Moon, The Wilding, and most recently The Dark Net, plus two story collections. So, welcome, Ben. So we're here today to talk about dystopian fiction, resistance, and rebellion. And I'm going to start by asking the authors each to read a little bit from their books to give you a sense of the different worlds they have created. And then we'll have a chat. And hopefully at the end, if there's time, we'll open it up to you guys if you have any questions. Start thinking about them now. And Lydia, seeing as you're right beside me, do you want to kick off?
Okay. First of all, I'm thrilled to be reading with the two of these men. I already know them and all of their work, and it's thrilling to get to do something with you both. You inspire me a great deal. But our topic has something to do with dystopias, dystopian things. But I maintain that I wrote a love story. It just happens to have war, violence, and dystopia. So I'm going to read a tiny piece that's about love inside the category of dystopia, okay? Oh, love, why couldn't you be real? It isn't that love died, it's that we storied it so poorly. We tried too hard to contain it and make it something to have and to hold for just ourselves. Love was never meant to be less than electrical impulse and the energy of matter, but that was no small thing. The Earth's heartbeat or pulse or telluric current, no small thing. The stuff of life itself, life in the universe, cosmic or as small as an atom. But we were greedy. We wanted love to be ours alone, between us, for us. We made it small and private between two people so that we'd be above all other living things. We made it a word, and then a story, and then a reason to care more about ourselves than anything else on the planet. Our love became bigger than the place we live. Our reasons to love more important than anything else. Love of God, love of husband or wife, love of children. There was no planet in that story. The stars were never there for us. We're not the reason for the night sky. The stars are us. It's where we go. We made love stories up so we could believe the night sky was not so vast, so unbearably vast that we barely matter. From what Trinculo said, Joan was closer to matter than human, and thus closer to the planet. If we ever knew what love was, let the story loosen itself away from us. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Lydia. What a wonderful way to start with talk about love, because all of these works obviously deal with dystopian fictional worlds in which there's a lot more than love and a lot of war. Which actually brings us to Omar's book, if you're ready to read a little piece from your book, American War.
Thank you so much for coming out, everybody. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to share the stage with three incredibly talented human beings. I'm going to read from the very beginning in large part because it's such a convoluted book that if I tried to read from any further on, I'd have to explain for about half an hour or so. This is pretty well from the beginning of chapter one. The sun broke through a pilgrimage of clouds and cast its unblinking eye upon the Mississippi Sea. The coastal waters were brown and still. The sea's mouth opened wide over ruined marshland, and every year grew wider, the water picking away at the silt and sand and clay, until the old riverside plantations and plastics factories and marine railways became unstable. Before the buildings slid into the water for good, they were stripped of their usable parts by the Delta's last holdout residents. The water swallowed the land. To the southeast, the once glorious city of New Orleans became a well within the walls of its levees, the baptismal rites of a new America. A little girl, 6 years old, sat on the porch of her family's home under a clapboard awning. She held a plastic container of honey, which was made in the shape of a bear. From the top of its head, golden liquid slid out onto the cheap pine floorboard. The girl poured the honey into the wood's deep knots and watched the serpentine manner in which the liquid took to the contours of its new surroundings. This is her earliest memory, the moment she begins. And this is how, in those moments when the bitterness subsides, I choose to remember her, a child. I wish I had known her then, in those years when she was still unbroken. "Sarah Chestnut, what do you think you're doing?" said the girl's mother, standing behind her near the door of the shipping container in which the Chestnuts made their home. "What did I tell you about wasting what's not yours to waste?" "Sorry, Mama. Did you work to buy that honey?" "No, I don't think you did. Go get your sister and get your butt to breakfast before your daddy leaves." "Okay, Mama," the girl said, handing back the half-empty container. She ducked past her mother, who patted dirt from the seat of her fleur-de-lis dress. Her name was Sarah T. Chestnut, but she called herself Surratt. The latter was born of a misunderstanding at the schoolhouse earlier that year. The new kindergarten teacher accidentally read the girl's middle initial as the last letter of her first name, Surratt. To the little girl's ears, the new name had a bite to it. Sarah ended with an impotent exhale, a fading ah that disappeared into the air. Surratt snapped shut like a bear trap. A few months later, the school shut down, most of the teachers and students forced northward by the encroaching war. But the name stuck, Surratt. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Omar. And then we have one more reading, and then we're going to do a lot of talking about dystopia. Get ready. Ben?
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming out. It is possible that during the reading, the church may burst into flames, just to warn you. Used to be, to open a door, you rolled aside a stone. Centuries later, you lifted a latch. Then you fitted a key, turned a knob. Now, you can open a door with a phone, or a fingerprint, or a voice command. Times change. The ways of entry change. But you still have to open the door. On this October 31st, Samhain, All Saints' Eve, All Hallows' Eve, Halloween, the fall climax, when the division between this world and the other frails, they open the door. For the past few years, Undertown Incorporated has been busy harvesting information. 80 million accounts from Anthem and 70 million from Target. 56 million from Home Depot, 76 million from JP Morgan Chase, Ashley Madison, AOL, British Airways, Living Social, Adobe, UPS and eBay and Blizzard and Domino's, and more, so many more, amassing information. Every time news broke about a data hack, people panicked, worrying over their credit cards and bank accounts especially. But when nothing happened, when no mysterious charges appeared, when no one applied for a credit card or a loan in their name, they forgot. They only worried about money, as though money were the only thing worth stealing. But Undertown wanted usernames and passcodes, the more subtle but severely damaging information, because that is the way in. The ciphered connection between your fingertips and keyboard, Jimmy's open the lock. This is what everyone should be worried about, not their accounts, but their identity. Snowden leaks the NSA files. Hackers leak the Sony emails. Facebook and Google track your browsing habits, your buying habits, your location, your age, gender, religion, orientation, and custom fit their ads accordingly. DNA has been replaced by streams of data. And it has become dangerously clear how your digital footprint can come back to haunt you with so much of your life online, just like that. You can be erased. Pirated, stalked, possessed. For now, Portland is the target. Portland is the focus group. Portland is the door.
You scared? I'm terrified. Ben, can I ask you, just as you've just finished, you know, when you've all written about imagined worlds and sort of dystopian realities, you chose to focus yours on technology and on the terrible effects of our technological dependence, which sounds, you know, futuristic but also very present. Why did you choose that as a as the box to open.
Well, fantasy stories, horror stories, oftentimes have some connection to cultural unease. If you think about, if you go back to like Frankenstein and its connection to the Industrial Revolution and the fear of science and technology and the fear of man playing God, if you think about Invasion of the Body Snatchers and its connection to McCarthyism and the Red Scare, if you think about Godzilla as a manifestation of post-atomic anxieties, what do we fear right now? We have a lot of things to be afraid of right now, but cybercrime is chief among them. Technology makes us very nervous. Every time your computer makes that carpenter ant sound, every time the screen glitches, you wonder, has it already begun, right? is a worm tunneling through the guts of this thing right now? You know, is an online avatar in my name being born in Russia at this very moment?
Yes.
And so I'm taking advantage of that.
Might as well profit from it, yeah.
And we rely so heavily on our devices, right? We treat our phones like a prosthetic cerebrum. You are always turning your face toward a tablet or a laptop, and yet you don't really understand these devices, the way they work, and you also don't understand or don't care about how much information that you are giving up on a daily basis. Because every time you swipe that screen, every time you click a mouse, every time you clack that keyboard, that information is being fed into an algorithm, sometimes for commercial purposes, but sometimes for more nefarious reasons. And I was nervous about this myself and wanted to understand it better, and I emerged out the other end of it more paranoid.
Has it changed how you use technology yourself, just even writing this book? Has it altered your own habits?
Yeah, I mean, if I think back to 3 years ago, that's when, you know, I used to be a bit of a Luddite. Instead of Microsoft Word, I used a stone tablet and a chisel, and I sent ravens instead of emails, and my smartphone was a tin can with a very long string. And then I came across this article in Time magazine. It was by Lev Grossman, the author of The Magicians. It was about Silk Road. And I thought, I knew that this was going to be my next novel. I knew it would be about the deep web and the dark net. But I also realized how much I did not know and how much research was ahead of me. And so I scammed my way into writing this book, in that I pitched a bunch of nonfiction articles, including one to GQ, about technology. And this got me on the front lines of the industry. So not only did I get sent all of this gear to my house, you know, I had like 5 Apple Watches and 3 Fitbits. I had Google Glass. The Fitbit, by the way, after a day of writing, I looked at it and I had burned 42 calories.
Writing's hard, you guys.
I threw it away. It was clearly broken. But I also, in addition to getting all this gear, I traveled to the Google campus. And I rode in a driverless car. And I spoke to all these frontline researchers, and they also created, you know, several clones of me. Clone number 3 is standing before you right now. And I was talking to them, and I was talking to Apple, and I was talking to Verizon, and I was talking also to some gray hats in the hacking community. And one of the things I learned about was how, you can download. They knew the possibility then of downloading information like software onto human DNA. And there was an article that broke the other day about that very subject, that people can carry malware inside of them, which is, in a way, the subject of the book. I learned about how the Russians and the Chinese were inside the walls of virtually every institution in this country. It was just a question of what they were going to do with that access. And then the news of the election broke. And I could tell you all of the different things that have sort of come true nightmarishly. I mean, clearly I am Nostradamus, if you look at this book. But in the meantime of writing this, but you know, I've made small changes. Like, I don't really do anything on my computer except write and check email. I also have a piece of electrical tape over the camera so that nobody can spy on me picking my nose and writing bad novels all day.
They're looking for that.
Because on the dark net, I mean, people are, they are auctioning off your cameras. Like an actual version of the real world, you know. People are accessing cameras, they're accessing microphones and spying on people. So, I mean, I could keep going and keep going, and you would all run out of here screaming and pulling in your hair. But that's the quick and dirty version of it.
Well, on to much more upbeat thoughts of climate change. And I wanted to ask, I mean, Omar and Lydia, both of you imagined in very different ways a future where our relationship with the planet has been torqued to such an extent that, a disruptive extent, and has had very real consequences for its inhabitants. And Lydia, I know that you just, I really love the passage you just read because it sort of spoke to the heart of what, you know, of the book about our relationship with the Earth and our perceived relationship, our sense of ourselves. Tell me about what, I mean, and it seems to grapple very closely with how we have affected our planet and how we perceive ourselves as custodians of the planet. Tell me a little bit about why that was the dystopian reality that you decided to write about. This is going to be grim, you guys. Sorry.
Well, I was, in addition to being completely obsessed with Joan of Arc, which is just a personal thing. Raise your hand if you've ever been weirdly obsessed with Joan of Arc. Yeah. I see you. I was very interested in kind of zooming in on three mono stories we tell ourselves in West, not just Western culture, but particularly in Western culture, the love story, the God story, and the war story. And we've understood our own history as plugging into one of those three mono stories to a large extent. And so I set about an impossible task to unwrite the love story, the God story, and the war story, which isn't possible, so it's a complete failure. Don't even try to see if I resolve that, because I didn't. But while I was inside there, which happens every time I try to write a book and kind of fail at the thing I'm scratching at, but I discover this whole set of interesting, puzzling, mind-bogglingly cool places to be. And one of the places, as I was trying to unwrite, what do we mean when we say love story? First of all, is what we mean. If you're a woman, we never got the story. We never got to be the one who was the main character in the story. The love story as a trope only includes woman as object. This is a news flash, in case you don't know. So while I was in there trying to unwrite the love story, and I actually did a bunch of research on the birth of the love story in literature and philosophy and theology, and it's really interesting if you ever look it up. You can see how quickly we went awry if you study the history of it. And one of the things I came to was a question, which is, what if we loved the planet we live on the way we talk about loving the people we love the most in our lives? What if we had the same kind of devotion that we have to our most loved ones, like my son and my husband and my family? What if I could experience that love, that level of erotic love, devotional love, familial love, the thing, if you try to hurt my son, I will kill you, love, whatever, for the planet? And what about that? And how come we don't? And what would that mean? And of course, it is true, many cultures older than America, which is really young and puny and pathetic in terms of its age, older cultures did have profound relationships to the planet. So this isn't new, this question I'm asking, but the storylines have been taken away from us by the dark web. It's Ben's fault.
Lydia's also a clone, just so you know.
But that's what I was up to with that strand of the storyline, trying to unwrite a story to see if there could be other stories under it.
Thank you. And Omer, in the dystopian reality that you created in American War, it's in a future where, again, where climate change has had a real impact, but you chose to overlay these historical North-South tensions in this country with like a futuristic energy crisis, or I don't know how futuristic it really is, but tell me a little bit about why you made that decision.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing I can think of to a Genesis moment for this book had to do with a very vague recollection I have from many years ago now of watching an interview with a foreign affairs expert. I don't remember if it was on CNN or one of the other networks. This is one of these talking heads they bring in periodically to explain the world. And the interview was taking place in the immediate aftermath of a set of protests that had taken place in Afghanistan. Local villagers were protesting against the US military presence. And the question that was put to this gentleman was something along the lines of, why do they hate us so much? And as part of his answer, he noted that sometimes the special forces have to go into these villages and conduct nighttime raids looking for insurgents. And that when they do this, they will sometimes ransack the houses or hold the women and children at gunpoint. And then he helpfully added, and you know, in Afghan culture, that sort of thing is considered very offensive.
Nice.
I thought, you know, name me one culture on earth that wouldn't consider this sort of thing offensive. And so that's when I first started thinking about this idea of taking the conflicts that have defined the world in my lifetime, and these are conflicts in which U.S. involvement has either been indirect or from a great distance, and recasting them as elements of something close to home. And I couldn't think of anything closer to home than a civil war where you're fighting yourself. The whole point being to discuss this idea that there is no foreign form of suffering. There's no exotic reaction to injustice. All of us react to injustice the same way. Some of us just have the privilege to believe otherwise. And so that was the genesis of the thinking that got me started on this novel. I started in summer of 2014, finished the first draft of the manuscript summer of 2015. About 3 weeks later, Donald Trump announced he was running for president. And ever since then, the context in which this book has been read has been completely different than what I intended. You know, this thing I intended as a work of allegory or analogy has instead been seen as a kind of weird roadmap. You know, like this is how it could happen, which is strange to me because all of this did happen. It just happened to somebody all the way over there.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up our president.
Are you really?
Well, I want to talk about how, you know, you all began these books before his appearance in the political realm, and at that time, writing about dystopia feels like it must have been a different exercise. And then we had a really abrupt reality schism, and now many people believe, myself included, that we're living in a more dystopic world. Do you think you would have written things differently? If you were starting these books now, would they be different? I mean, I've heard people talk about, God, dystopia, but we're kind of in one now. How do you, you know, would you, Lydia, would you approach the book any differently given what's happened since you first conceived of it?
So the villain-ish character in my book starts out as a billionaire talk show host on reality TV success story. Who, like, weirdly and ascends to power in his area, and then the United States, and then the world.
It's kind of on the nose, yeah.
But like Omar, I mean, we were all writing before any of this current shit went down. But I think about it, and we were also all writing within a zeitgeist with these exact tensions in it, and. Would I have written the book differently or started it differently or thought about it differently? Probably. I mean, on the other hand, I think this Trump person, that's all I can bring myself to call him. And this is not a positive thing to say. In some ways, it's a logical extension of late capitalism, and we should have seen this coming a long time ago, and so he doesn't seem like this, oh my God, anomaly to me. It's like, oh, look what we've done. And it caught up to us, and it has orange hair. But another thing that came very clean and clear to me quite quickly is that we're walking around in America acting like, oh, now we have a dystopia, and that is so ridiculous. Because that we is a privileged we, where we haven't had to live in poverty and famine in the same ways as the rest of the world, or even some neighbors down the street, usually, in a discussion like this. The apocalypse has been around since history began. And so this particular storyline of it is interesting, but it's not new. It's not new. It's just particularly cartoonish and glaring and has no nuance or worth.
I'm wondering, do you think as well that this, all three of you are giving voice to, you know, a malaise, whether it's wherever it's located, but does it feel like a particularly American discomfort? Because I read somewhere, and I wish I could remember his name because that would be a good place to shout it out, somebody even pointing out about that there's been a, even the Make America Great Again slogan was a yearning for a perceived utopia, and that America has long been preoccupied with a sense of utopia or something lost. Do you think these books have that kind of something American at their very core? I guess I'll ask Omar, because yours has it in the title.
Yeah, and it's a really pretentious thing for me to say, but I never thought of it as an American book. I mean, one of the reasons it has this cover and not one of, I think we went through about 45 different cover designs, and about 44 of them had melting stars or stars and stripes or stylized American flags, and we went with this one precisely because I didn't think of it primarily as a book about America. I thought of it primarily as a book about the universality of revenge and the way we all sort of react when subjected to injustice. Look, I mean, I agree 100% with what Lydia said. I mean, in my mind, none of what's happening right now is new. It's just that the things that for decades have been whispered at the most vulnerable communities in this country, it's now suddenly okay to shout out loud. You know, the Nazis who were marching in Charlottesville didn't show up yesterday. They've been around. What they have now is permission. Right, and that's the really scary change. Nothing fundamental has changed. You know, I on almost exactly a year ago on election night, the German publisher of this book asked a bunch of us authors, their authors in the U.S., to write blog posts about our feelings on election night. And so, okay, I started writing, and by 8 p.m. I had like, you know, 10 paragraphs of copy, and by 3 a.m. I had to delete all of it and start from scratch. That's how certain I was that Hillary Clinton was going to win. So not only did I not predict any of this, had I predicted it perfectly and wrote a novel based on that kind of world and tried to sell it in 2015, not a single publisher would have bought it.
Correct.
They would have told me to tone it down, right? So in a way, I'm really glad that that wasn't the moving target that I was trying to chase, because it would have been a much worse book. You know, what I was trying to do was reverse something that we're really used to seeing in the other direction. Think of any Jason Bourne movie, any James Bond movie you've ever seen. There's always scenes in an exotic Caribbean island or a Moroccan bazaar, and that's the table. They're laying a different tablecloth on top of that. Somebody else's story is being told on top. All I'm doing is using that in the opposite direction, right? America's the table, and I'm laying a different tablecloth on it. But of course, you know, America has the last laugh because it moves in a direction that's so dystopian that now this novel is taken in an entirely different context than the one I wrote it. But it wasn't my intention going in.
Ben, yours is set right here in Portland, and it's very specifically so. A lot of the milieu is really recognizable. Tell me about your decision to locate it here.
Sure. Well, first though, you were asking, you know, how would our books be any different if we had written them today, as opposed to a few years ago? And I don't know, when I look at the news right now, and when I log on to social media, I kind of just want to watch, you know, Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
And purify, I'd probably be writing puppies. I'd be writing puppy fiction.
Yeah.
Something to make us feel better. I mean, it's hard to compete with the news cycle right
now. That's right, yeah. And if you know, I was watching a show called Mindhunters. It's about the dawn of profilers, criminal profilers. And these FBI agents are interviewing different people and trying to understand the psychology of killers. And this is during the Son of Sam era. And one of the things they do is they talk about how crime is oftentimes reflective of the society. And how you used to be able to, in the 50s, when the old, you know, old guys in the bureau were trying to track down criminals, it used to be you could be like, all right, there's a jilted lover. Or somebody who was fired from work, and you're able to track the motive. But when they look at Son of Sam, or they look at the Night Stalker, when they look at these serial killers, there's no motive. And they're saying that it is potentially reflective of you know, the Watergate era, the Vietnam era, the chaos of the country. I feel like that's going on right now as well. I mean, if we talk about the cyclical nature of all these stories, what's going on in the country right now when you see somebody rain down all those bullets in Las Vegas, like there's no motive, right? And this, I think that it's not just reflective of the crimes that can occur in this country, but it's also the chaos of things politically, environmentally, culturally. It's reflected in our art as well.
Well, we're supposed to also be talking about resistance and rebellion, and I feel like your books offer three very different models for that. And Lydia, maybe if we start with Christine's form of resistance. I'm interested in her use of storytelling as resistance. And it obviously makes me think about you as a writer too, and how, and your own forms of resistance. And if this is, yeah, how you view storytelling as a way to resist a dystopian reality.
I guess the answer has to be I do. I guess pretty much everything I've ever written has that at its heart. And even this most recent book, it's ridiculously called The Misfits Manifesto. And the only reason I'm telling you about it is because I talked Simon and Schuster into letting 9 other people tell their stories along with me in the book. And the idea was similarly, if you listen to more stories, it's harder to cancel a single story across from you out. If you make a plurality of voice in storytelling, it's harder to decide this person sucks and this person is good because I'm just going with my one story I carry around. So I actually do believe storytelling is a form of resistance. It also gets used against us all the time. And so the power goes both ways. In the book, I took it to an extreme where the form of representation is that the people are burning stories onto their skin. I was expecting some kind of shot of lightning as a recovering Catholic, but nothing's happening. To bring the idea back to a phrase that shows up in more than one sacred text in the world, but with different versions, that in the beginning was the Word, and then instead of "and the Word was God," I took it to the body and asked what would happen if we'd owned the story from the start and hadn't donated it skyward. And so in that sense, storytelling would be an act of blasphemy in addition to being a form of resistance. You have to read it. It's weird.
Ben, in your case, your rebels are almost the definition of a misfit gang. You have like the disabled girl, a blind man, a loner, a technophobic journalist, a homeless guy, like this, you know, mix of...
I love them.
Is that how you see, is that how you see us, the world being saved by the people on the margins? Is that why you chose them?
Yeah, I chose them for that reason, and also others that are a little more practical in terms of the narrative. The one girl who you mentioned, Hannah, she has RP, so her vision is failing. And I was interested in that for a few reasons. One, I love Anthony Doerr's The Shell Collector. I also loved his All the Light We Cannot See, and I thought that was such a good challenge to take away vision, because it's a sense that I rely upon so heavily in my fiction. You know, it's a crutch we all lean on. If I took that away, how could I write? Because I wanted that challenge. I always have a challenge in store for me, or many challenges in store for me in every book, like writing about technology, writing an urban novel, since so many of my other books are outdoorsy. So writing from the perspective of somebody who is visually challenged was interesting to me for that reason, but also I wanted a character who could, you know, who was used to encountering the world in a different way, reading the world in a different way, understanding the symbols of the world in a different way, so that I could have somebody who could transcend this world and go into the other and be able to kind of engage with the digital world in a matrixy kind of way. So she was one of my ways in. And then I had this journalist character. This character works for the Oregonian. And in every narrative or you have something otherworldly going on. You know, if you look at a fantasy novel, they're big for a reason, because you have to explain all this stuff. You have to explain the politics of the realm or the mating habits of dragons or whatever. Like, fantasy novels are all this big as a result of that. Science fiction novels are all big because you have to describe the ship at length and the technology on the ship and the alien cultures and whatever else. And, you know, sometimes that exposition can be tiring and unnatural, the constant, you know, force-fed Wikipedia entries. And if you have a rookie character, then it feels more organic, because you are learning alongside that character. So with the journalist character, journalists are always the best characters in any book, because they're always driven on a mission. They can, you know, move around and talk to all sorts of different people.
And poorly paid, just to remind you.
And this character is, yeah, it was definitely based on you. And this character is sort of technophobic, like me, and probably doesn't understand, like most of the readers, a lot about this world. This digital realm. So we are just like Harry Potter, right? He knows nothing about the world of magic, and neither do the readers. And so you learn about Hogwarts and spells with him, and so you're aligned with this journalist in learning all about the dark web. Hopefully, in a way where you're getting these little gerbil pellets of information that don't feel overwhelming. But yeah, a ragtag crew that doesn't necessarily get along. You know, having warring personalities. You know, one character he runs this shop in the Pearl District called Geek, and he's a tech guy. And, you know, he views himself as like a one-man Anonymous version of Anonymous.
Yeah,
and
I loved him.
He's like 5 feet tall and wears boots that cheat him a little bit of height. And, you know,
doesn't want to
he's a huge man online, but a small man in our world. And yeah, I just love the way that they all crash together. And became reluctant allies in this battle against evil.
He's got the perfect voice for
best
this.
Best voice ever.
Really. Omar, in the case of Surratt, who takes resistance and rebellion to the farthest in many ways and at the greatest cost, tell me a little bit about the creation of her character and why it was necessary for her to go that far.
Yeah, the book. A lot of the book is about the process of radicalization. You know, so I'm one of these people who believes that you can be born bad, but you have to be made evil. And so it's a process of how somebody can be made evil. And a lot of it is based on stuff that I saw. I mean, I started work as a journalist, as a full-time journalist at the Globe and Mail in Canada on a Monday in the summer of 2006, and on that Friday, I think, we had the biggest terrorism arrest in Canadian history, this thing called the Toronto 18 case. 18 kids, and some of them were kids, I mean, some of them were like 17 years old, who had all these grand plans to behead the prime minister, blow up Parliament Hill. None of it came true. They were being watched the whole time. The guy who was selling the fertilizer for the bomb was an agent with the police force. Anyway, the Globe got beat on that story the first day. The two other major papers in Canada had big blowout sections, and we had an item on A2, about five lines. So the next day, the editor was pissed off, and he calls an all-hands-on-deck meeting. 300 journalists in the room. He's looking around the room. He's looking for anyone who has experience with the Middle East, because some of these people's backgrounds were from the Middle East, anybody who has any experience with Islam. And he's looking for brown people. And he looks around the room, and he finds two. In a room of 300, he finds me, and he finds the theater critic. And so he says, you two, you're going out to the mosques tomorrow, you're going to interview the people who knew these kids, you're going to do some hard-hitting street journalism. You're okay, fine, that's my job. I go, I'm coming back, I'm writing. Buddy comes back, gives me his file, and he's giving me 500 of the most beautiful words I've ever read on the color of the drapes in the mosque and the acoustics and that was the start of 2 years on that story. I spent 2 years writing about these kids and how you can go from being this kid on living in the suburbs of Mississauga, which is on the outskirts of Toronto, born in Canada, raised in Canada, and how you can go from that to somebody who's building detonators in his house off YouTube videos. And I was fascinated by that idea. I think the prerequisite for solving any problem is understanding it. And when we meet extremists, we tend to meet them at the finish line. We meet them when they've done whatever horrible thing they're going to do. We rarely look at the rest of the race. And so this book is essentially the rest of the race. And it furthers the idea that you can understand why somebody does something without taking their side. And in fact, that's a necessary prerequisite for a solution.
Guys, I have a lot more questions, but I wanted to offer some audience members the opportunity. I think there'll be somebody going around with a mic from somewhere. But if you have a question, just raise your hand. I see a few up here. Yeah.
Do you think now, because fiction is all, the fiction you very write beautifully is all of a sudden becoming nonfiction, you think now dystopia is going to have like a happy ending? And, you know, we put the two wires together and we saved ourselves. Yay.
I mean, Ben, you got to take this one.
All post-apocalyptic books have hope, it seems like. Even The Road, which is the most bleak narrative of all time, there's the Coke can scene, right? And there's the moment at the end where you think things might turn out all right with the trouts swimming in the streams with the boy. You know, I was thinking about fairy tales a lot when I wrote this, and one of the things that fairy tales did, if you think back to, you know, the Black Forest of Germany and the Brothers Grimm, you know, there might be a child that died in a meadow, and a story might rise out of that about a cunning wolf, a wolf with evil intelligence. Or there might have been a disturbed grave, and somebody was buried alive due to poor medical practices, and the myth of vampirism rose out of that. And there were stories that were told to make sense of what we couldn't make, they couldn't make sense of back then. And I was thinking about that when it comes to, you know, technology, and there's so much we don't comprehend. Right now, there are signals streaming through all of our bodies, these ghostly signals in the room with us right now. And as much as you rely on your phone, you have no idea how it works. You can't fix your car anymore because it's all computerized and on and on and on. And I was trying, I guess I felt like we're surrounded by a new sort of wilderness now, a digital wilderness. And I was trying to write this story to make sense of it. And I think that's why a lot of people are reading and writing post-apocalyptic or dystopian fiction, is that you're trying to struggle with this thing that you can't make sense of. And hopefully the book will provide you with some sort of answers that feel safer than what the world might offer.
It's kind of a happy ending.
Puppies.
We have a question over here. Oh, we have so many questions. This is great. While you're making your way over, I have one more question, I have several more. But one of them, I was interested that all of you had as your... your rebels, your resistors, in each case, are predominantly female. Yeah, just saying. Lydia, can you tell me, was that a conscious decision on your part? Was that
because I have boobs?
Because you have boobs. We can talk about the women stuff, right?
The characters in all my books are quite consciously constructed, and I don't write solo main characters. I never will again. I don't believe in that trope anymore. And I also just think that we're at a time and place where the rest of storytelling has a chance to rise up and through the cracks and fissures and tensions of our current moment. So when I say that, I mean women and LGBT people and people of color and indigenous folks. And I'm just actually incredibly excited at this moment in history, even though it's terrifying, the things that are happening. It's also a chance where those openings and cracks and fissures may yet yield the rest of history and the rest of storytelling and the rest of the bodies that have been used as the raw material for a fiction about progress in culture. That's what I have to say about that. And puppies.
And puppies.
Yeah, a few years ago, I was at a comic book shop with my kids, and my daughter came up to me with a sour look on her face, and I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "Where are all the girl heroes?"
That's all it
and
took.
That's all it took, yeah. I think about that every time I sit down at the desk.
Omar, why did you make Surat, you know, the protagonist in a way? Why was she a female character for you?
Yeah, I have a few answers for that, none of them particularly satisfactory, so I apologize in advance, but... one is that when we talk about radicalization, it's almost always viewed through the prism of men, and I wanted to explore it through a different prism. The other is that I was sick of reading stories about straight white guys, which is a large part of it. I mean, you know, It gets applause, but it's a massive part of the canon, right? Like that's and the canon matters because the canon sticks around for a long time, and tells you what's worth writing about and what isn't. Also, I've never tried to chase down the emotional motivations of a man and not ultimately been disappointed by what I found. And so that may be my own failure, a failure of my own perception, but it's a sense that you go into writing fiction to chase questions that you don't, that are interesting to you because they're complex and you don't have the answers to them. And maybe it's just the men I hang around with, but it was just a sense of just ultimately not having a basis there that feels full. Now, all of these things are counterweight against the fact that I am not female and I am writing outside of myself, and do I have any right to do that? And that's an open question for me, and that's something I think about a lot, and whether I had any right to do this in the first place. I think having chased down that particular form of narrative, I'm at least obligated to do so in good faith and to explain my reasoning why. But it's still an open question for me whether I had the right to do that in the first place, and that's something I think about a lot.
Well, thank you guys. Thank you everybody for coming.
Thank you so much, everyone.
That was a conversation between writers Benjamin Percy, Lydia Yuknovich, and Omar El-Akkad from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.